Hi everyone, it's your host Amy Geckel, and we are back with entry 15 of the Eating Disorder Diaries. Today I'm joined by Caroline Thomason, a registered dietitian based out of the Washington, D.C. area who is passionate about helping people find a healthy and confident relationship with food. Couldn't we all use some help with that? She works with a lot of clients who have a history of disordered eating or eating disorders. And today we talk about the underlying theme of trauma and how that can relate to a bad relationship with food and your body and the way that you talk to yourself.
I also ask her some of my most pressing questions on fasting and bloating and should we be avoiding certain foods?
Caroline has been featured on MSN, Parade Magazine, The Huff Post, Eat This Not That, and The Spruce Eats, just to name a few. So needless to say, she does a lot, but one thing she is not is your average dietitian. Stay tuned to hear why. Here's Caroline Thomason in entry 15, how a dietitian can help treat your eating disorder. Caroline Thomason, welcome to the Eating Disorder Diaries.
Thank you so much. So excited to be here.
I'm so excited that we discovered each other. You are a woman that wears many hats. One of those hats is that you're a dietitian. So I want to take a step back for the listeners who maybe don't know, but are very curious. What does a dietitian do? Like, what is the definition of a dietitian even?
Such a good question, because there is a difference between dietitians and nutritionists. And, you know, a lot of dietitians call themselves nutritionists. Like, I'm totally fine with that title as well. But in terms of like schooling and education, dietitians will go through like a comprehensive nutrition program and come out on the other side after their internship with this credential, whereas nutritionist is an unregulated term. So I always like to clarify that for people. It's kind of a semantics thing, but at the end of the day, it does matter in terms of like, are you getting credible information from somebody who went to school for this? So that's, you know, what a dietitian is at the end of the day could be a variety of different things. You could work in a hospital and do clinical nutrition, you do outpatient counseling, you can do eating disorder treatment and therapy, which is what my background is in. You can specialize in a variety of different fields too. So diabetes, cardiovascular, et cetera.
Yeah, I've been guilty for using the term dietitian and nutritionist interchangeably. So it's good to get kind of the clarification. And you mentioned that you work with a lot of clients who have suffered from eating disorders before. So, I mean, just taking even a step back, while this podcast relates to people who have suffered from eating disorders before, who's a good candidate to see a dietitian?
Oh, I love that you asked that because, yeah, of course, if you have like a diagnosed situation, like an eating disorder or a health condition, it makes so much sense to see a dietitian specifically for that. But to your point, like even in my private practice, I would say the overwhelming majority of my private practice is just people who come to me and they're like, I don't know. I feel like I could eat better. I don't really know where to start. I feel overwhelmed and stressed with food. And so they have a lot of these like vague kind of, I just feel like it could be better feelings. And I think that is probably where the average person might be in terms of wanting to hire a dietitian for help. So I think you don't have to wait until something happens. You can totally work on your relationship with food and understanding nutrition way before then.
Yeah, I think that's really relatable. And most recently, I've seen a nutritionist with sort of just the goal of learning more about what I'm putting in my body. It seems like sometimes I eat something and it just makes me feel like crap for days on end. And I want to learn how I can fix that, how I can pick up on more of my cues. So that's been something that's been newer for me in my adult life. If I
say I were to go see you as one of your clients, what can I expect in like a typical like day to day for us?
So the way that I operate in my private practice with clients, it's a little bit different than your average dietitian. So, you know, if you were to contract, for example, with your insurance company and see a dietitian, or go to your local hospital and see a dietitian, a lot of times that experience is going to be, you know, similar to a doctor's visit. You go in, you give them your history, they do an assessment, they give you all the information, all the handouts. And that's great. And I did that for years, so I really can't hate on it so much. But I really felt like people needed more support and more accountability. And that is kind of what led me to do things differently in my private practice. So the way that I do things is kind of like a membership. It's literally like a membership for a dietitian, the same way that you would have a membership for the gym or like a personal trainer or something. The reason being, I can offer so many more touch points outside of just like our one-on-one FaceTime on our calls, where I do like a weekly check-in with everybody. They can track their food in an app that I see. That's a whole nother conversation. And especially for folks with eating disorder histories, they do a lot of like picture-based food tracking where they're just taking pictures, or we're learning like intuitive eating cues. So not to get too much in the weeds there, but there's a variety of ways that my clients will end up tracking their food, and it's not like all numbers-based. So that's kind of the gist of how the membership runs and all the different touch points I offer.
I think that's really cool that you offer, you know, so many different touch points throughout the week, and you don't just have to wait until Tuesdays at 4 to go tell your dietitian what you ate for the week and if you're feeling good or if you're feeling bad. So I think that's critical and can really help someone in eating disorder, disordered eating recovery. And that's another term that I use pretty interchangeably that I think there's a pretty distinct difference between that I'd like your help clarifying. What's the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder?
You know, disordered eating, I think, has gotten a lot of media attention, especially as like more dietitians become kind of anti-diet culture. And so I think of disordered eating as just this general feeling, kind of like we were just describing, this general feeling of like, I'm stressed, I'm overwhelmed, I feel like I go through, you know, big swings in my eating, nothing feels stable and regulated for me. And most people identify with that, but most people would not say, I have a disordered relationship with food, right? So it's like, okay, but the feeling you have is like, I'm stressed, I'm overwhelmed, this is confusing, I need help. So we can call that whatever we want. And disordered eating really exists on a spectrum. So it's hard to identify like, oh, this person has a really bad relationship with food, or really disordered relationship with food. They might just have a hard time making choices when they eat out, but other parts of their relationship with food feel totally great. So everyone's so different in that way. So I say all of that to say, like, disordered eating is a huge umbrella and a big spectrum of range of emotions. Eating disorders have like very specific criteria, right? And we know very specifically how eating disorders impact our quality of life and our mental health. Like binge eating disorder, for example, has a very specific number of times in a duration of time that you're engaging in binge eating. So we can diagnose those things based on those parameters and other like vital signs, like somebody's weight or weight history and their weight loss in a period of time, things like that. So when it comes to diagnosing eating disorders, it's very specific, and it's often a very, you know, marked change in their quality of life and ability to just function as a normal human being around food.
That really aligns to my story with an eating disorder. I honestly think it started with disordered eating behaviors and kind of trickled into becoming a full-fledged eating disorder. Years ago, I was seeing a therapist, and she likened eating disorders to being perfect storm diseases. There could be life events that happen. Maybe it starts with experiencing a trauma and then combined with social, environmental, genetic factors, whatever it is, the eating disorder really takes root from those disordered eating habits that you might have. And something that I've talked about a lot is the trauma that I experienced as a child. And as a result, I did, from a very young age, like 13, I started developing very disordered eating habits, hiding food as a seventh grader is what I specifically remember. And then a year after, you know, get wind of these other teenage girls engaging in eating disorder behaviors. That's really how mine full-on bulimia started. And that then was in my life for over a decade. Right. Working as a dietitian, what have you learned regarding the connection between maybe experiencing trauma or a traumatic event and combined with everything else in life, the connection between trauma and disordered eating or full-fledged eating disorders?
Well, I think you just framed it so beautifully. And just to highlight something you said about being like 13 and you have this really vivid memory of when things started, most people, whether they have disordered eating as part of their background or an eating disorder that's been diagnosed, have that moment of like, wow, that was the moment where I really remember something changed and I was acting different towards food. And it's almost always between the ages of 11 and 13. And we know that that's like when just puberty, we start becoming aware of our body, things are changing really fast. And suddenly the world is telling us, especially as women, like you should be smaller, you should be thinking about this, you should be watching your portion sizes. And so to your point, what a perfect storm. If you even have like a loving, wonderful environment that you've grown up in, that alone is enough for people to kind of stimulate something and plant that seed that kind of grows into an eating disorder or something maybe a little more benign, like disordered eating, but still affecting them as they grow up. And I would say every woman I've ever talked to, whether they have an eating disorder or not, has some kind of like experience that can relate to that in some ways from a young age. So I just wanted to highlight that, but then also answering your question, like there is the saying that your genetics load the gun, but your environment pulls the trigger. So your genetics being, you know, any medical or mental health history that could put you at risk for developing an eating disorder. And then your environment being trauma that happens to you, not growing up in a very supportive environment, having tons of diet culture messaging thrown at you from a young age, having people around you in your life kind of reinforcing that you should be eating less or that you should be dieting from a really young age. So all of those things really factor into that perfect storm.
Do you want real help for your relationship problems? Then you should check out Relationship Radio. We address issues that couples face every day. We have worked with thousands of couples over the past 24 years, and here's what we have learned: that there is always hope. And we also know that if anything works, the things that we teach you will. If you want to know how to make your relationship stronger, then this podcast is for you. You can find new episodes of Relationship Radio every Wednesday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I can only imagine how much harder it's even for 11 to 13 year old girls now with TikTok and Instagram and all of the social media. I mean, I'm 30. So at the time I was in seventh grade, eighth grade, yeah, we had like magazines and 17 and Cosmopolitan, and I'm sure things were Photoshopped. So of course there was a lot of comparison there. And I even remember at that age comparing myself in a bathing suit to other girls who looked differently than me. And there was a lot of pressure there, but I really hope that this podcast can raise awareness for girls of that age and maybe parents who are listening as well, who are concerned with their child, because these kids are being just, they're thrown these images at them. So it's got to be even more crippling and more like toxic to their mental health, I can only imagine. And just the more we know with eating disorders, disordered eating behaviors, events happening, all of that really onsetting between those ages, we just need to have awareness so we can then change how we're approaching situations differently. If I were to go back in time, I mean, I know much more now than I knew then, but I just wish I could equip myself with the knowledge and really at least start to get help, at least start to feel like I'm speaking from the mind of a 12-year-old here, but like, know that there are people who have been through it and people that will understand and people that can talk to you, even if you feel like you yourself don't know what's going on in your body. So, and I know for someone who's much older than 12, who hasn't been able to kick their disordered eating behaviors, I have to imagine, I think in my situation at least, my eating disorder lasted for almost 16 years on and off. And it would be, I call it, it would be at bay sometimes. And I think it would be during periods of life. I'll give an example. I dated someone who I changed myself completely for. I just stopped doing the things that I really liked to do because I just wanted this person to like me. And I think I shut myself off to a lot of things, but my eating disorder honestly like stopped for a couple of years while we were together. And then all of a sudden, my real self comes forward and my eating disorder behaviors come back. And I'm alarmed and disturbed because I'm older and I thought I had gotten rid of this thing. But really, I hadn't done any trauma work and I hadn't really done any deep diving into what had happened in my childhood. I wasn't really seriously seeing a therapist or talking things out. I didn't know myself the way I do now. And I really have done a lot of work to process this trauma in my body. And I think by working through this trauma that's literally been stuck in my body, that's allowed me to heal. And in turn, every facet of my life has gotten better, from my eating disorder to my mental health to my relationships with people, all of the above. And I think that a lot of people don't understand that trauma really does live in your body. And we know that trauma wreaks havoc on the body. So for those of us who aren't aware of what type of impact it can have on our bodies, what would you tell them?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yes. Everything you just said, I have to echo it too. And I mean, from social media nowadays to like, if I just go back for 1 second, I saw this social media post somewhere, someone had taken this compilation of old magazines from 2000. And it was like, Britney Spears. It was like the people that we looked up to at the time that were like not that much older than us. Like Britney, I'm almost 32. So like Britney was like 16 and we were 13, and like Jessica Simpson was like just getting out of teenage years. So anyways, they had taken this compilation and it was like commenting on their bodies and talking about, any scrutiny of change that this media outlet could notice. And granted, I don't think we have that kind of media today, but we grew up with this like delusional idea of what is quote unquote weight gain, what is quote unquote fat at the time. And I think the like general media now tends to be a little less critical of women's bodies. It's still out there for sure. But social media is like a whole nother beast because that is so intertwined with just like our day-to-day life and filters and only seeing people's highlight reels. It's like a whole nother kind of matrix inside our brain that a 12-year-old isn't taking in and being like, oh, this is someone's highlight reel and this isn't really real life. They're thinking like, why can I not be like this? And it is so different and so much more intense, I think, in that way. But to get back to your other question, also something else I'll just comment on super quickly is like when you go through those ebbs and flows and you go through periods of time where it does seem like you're better, or your behaviors aren't there. So often we're like transferring that sense of control or the escapism that we get through our eating disorder. We're just transferring that to something else. So being in that relationship maybe felt so like warm and cozy and escapey for you. And you just didn't need that part of your brain was occupied. Like you don't even need the eating disorder for 2 years to help you feel better. So I just wanted to comment on that too.
That was definitely the case for sure. For those of us who aren't aware of the impact trauma can have on our bodies, from digestion to just being stuck in our bodies, what would you tell them?
Okay. So the impact trauma and the impact that eating disorders have on trauma in our body, I think to your point, trauma does get stuck in our bodies. It gets stored in our bodies and our nervous system can be activated or suppressed as a result of that trauma. When you think about like fight or flight, a lot of people maybe live in kind of a heightened state after something being traumatic happening in their lives. Or the opposite, some people kind of go into shutdown mode as a result. And so you can live in either of those states and you can swing back and forth between the two. And the way that those nervous system changes affect us are, you know, everything from our mental health, depression and anxiety, to you brought up gut health and digestion, which is huge. And our nervous system is so closely tied to digestion. There's the vagus nerve goes from our brain to our stomach. So literally thoughts, emotions, feelings that we're having, however intense they may be, immediately get transmitted to our gut. And so that can cause IBS-like symptoms ranging from like diarrhea all the way to constipation. It can cause just nausea and vomiting just from the stress of those emotions being kind of stuck in our digestive system, for lack of a better term. To like sleep disturbances, mood. There's so many different systems of our body that can be impacted.
Yeah, I've heard a lot that it's very common for people who have suffered from eating disorders to have autoimmune diseases and IBS. And so it's just something you need to be aware of with, you know, these behaviors don't just have the impact of the right now. Like these can have very long-term impacts on your health. And that also kind of scared me and allowed me to do more of my research and be motivated to turn around my behaviors. You know, that wasn't the only motivating factor. I just wanted to get better and feel better. And like, I knew I had work to do. And I think that because I say my trauma was stuck, one analogy that my therapist uses that I've talked about in these episodes that I don't think it's a bad thing to repeat myself because it's so spot on, is that she likened trauma getting stuck in your body to being like having a knot in your hair. And what do you have to do to get your knot out? You have to continuously go at it, like with a brush or comb through it. And it's probably going to hurt when you're starting and it's not going to feel good. Just like how, when you're going at your trauma and really facing that and processing it, however you're doing that, whether it's through therapy or through meditations, journaling, a combination of all of the above, that's what I did, but it's going to hurt. But the more you go at it like that, the more it's going to get untangled. And all of a sudden the knot isn't going to be stuck in your hair anymore. And things are going to start flowing. And that's what really happened for me. And I love that analogy. And that's why I like to bring it up, because I can really visualize it. In what ways have you seen clients successfully process their trauma? And like, what results have you seen come from that? Because I have to imagine, you know, working as a dietitian, you're working with people who have suffered from eating disorders. A lot of that is probably resulting from a past trauma. I'm just curious, like, what have you seen in your day to day?
Yeah, I love that analogy too. And something that I see over and over and over again, and it can be so hard to see this when you're in the thick of recovery, is that you don't realize how much time and mental energy you're spending thinking about food and your body. And when you heal that, and when you work through those underlying triggers, like your trauma, you quite literally can become such a different person, and you meet parts of your personality that like you didn't even know existed. And it's because you have energy to actually think about, like, what would I be doing if I wasn't thinking about food all day? What would I want to do with my life if this wasn't so consuming for me? And so one of the, I think, biggest themes, no matter like what the client is going through or what we're addressing and working with, is that they just like blossom into this really, really amazing new part of themselves that they didn't even know. It's like surprising to them. Sometimes it's surprising to me, because to your point, you're like working through that knot, and it's like, it happens like gradually, gradually, suddenly. Like it's literally like, okay, we're inching. And then like one day, like things can just fall into place and you just feel the difference and you feel lighter. And I hear that from a lot of clients, is like, it's a struggle until one day it just feels better.
Oh, that's kind of comparable to my story too. I think that for a while, when I still felt like I was trying to recover, I was doing what I could, I was going to therapy, I was doing the things, I would still have behaviors from time to time. And that would be really frustrating for me. But there were other elements in my life that I think were not serving me. I was in a relationship that wasn't right for me at the time. Common theme in my life, right? But as soon as I really was authentic to myself and there was something telling me for years I had to get out of this relationship, but I would stay. So it was almost like I was lying to myself for a long time. So as soon as I really leaned in and listened to myself, it took me to a whole new level of recovery, if I'm being honest. And there was a trickle effect from there for sure. So I really blossomed after that. I was able to live alone, focus on waking up and like establishing my own type of morning routine, which I still do to this day. And that's a huge part of my recovery is I wake up, drink water, meditate, then journal. And that really helps me. And I just have kind of found my, I don't know, my vibe of what I like to do every single day. And I mean, even now, like I think with me working on the podcast, this is something I would have never been able to do, but I've really been able to break out of this damn eating disorder, which has sucked so much of my life for so long. And this is kind of how I'm showing that recovery is beautiful and you can really actually get to a point of recovery by doing things that you love and just meeting new parts of yourself. So I really appreciate like what you said there. And I have a few more rapid fire, but not really rapid fire questions for you. Take as long as you want to answer them. But aside from major traumas or environmental factors that we've talked about, I talked about not being in the right relationship. What other factors have you seen contribute to someone having an eating disorder so other people can be aware of what that might look like?
You know, people with eating disorders are so good at hiding it too. So like people in your life may not be aware, or they're aware, but you're really good at making it seem like you're fine. So there's that. I'm going to caveat everything with just that. But yeah. Some of the biggest environmental factors are just things that contribute to eating disorders are being surrounded by a lot of diet talk. And that could be somebody directing that at you, you know, sharing that you should be, someone telling you that you should be eating less, or that you should be on a diet, or that you should watch your weight, especially from a young age. That's so damaging. But it also could be you seeing someone else do that. Like, for example, I have a lot of clients who maybe had a really supportive family, but their mom was always really unhappy. And that was, you know, never directed at them, but they just grew up hearing it over and over and over again from a really close family member. And they just internalized those messages, which of course, how could you not hearing them over and over? And our parents and grandparents grew up in such a different time where that was such a big focus. And I think we're finally like at that turning point where parents are really trying not to instill those thoughts in kids, which is so cool to see. And I work with a lot of parents who are like, my mom did this to me and I don't want to do it to my kids. And it's really rewarding and really cool to see people break that kind of generational cycle. So I would say that's like the number one thing. And then of course, you know, engaging or being, I don't want to say forced, but in some cases forced to engage in those practices, of course, those would be like really big environmental things. And it also could be, you know, playing on a sports team, wrestlers have a really high eating disorder rate because they have this kind of team environment where the culture is around how does your body perform and look, and especially if you have to weigh in for any of those kinds of sports. That could be huge.
Yeah, definitely really triggering. And I mean, while I feel like a lot of social media is very addicting and toxic in a lot of ways, I think one beautiful thing about social media is the fact that we've been able to connect with people who are sharing their experiences with breaking free of an eating disorder or unlearning what they may have like been taught by their parents in childhood and relearning something else. And being able to witness those stories firsthand is really motivating, but also really helps you learn and understand that you can do that too. That might relate to my next question, which is, what are your thoughts on fasting? I feel like there's been a lot of talk lately about how good fasting can actually be for you, whether it's intermittent fasting, but I think for someone who's had an eating disorder, that can be a really sticky slope. So how can we use fasting as a tool and not a weapon? And would you even encourage anyone to fast?
Mm-hmm. Yes, fasting has really taken the world by storm the last few years. And okay, so with fasting, the person who comes to me and asks about fasting is going to dictate my response way more than like my top level one-off response. But to give you my like general thoughts on fasting, I will say I'm not like an anti-fasting, but I don't think that we need to like label it as I'm fasting and I'm going to, you know, have this strict eating window where from 12 noon to 5 p.m., that's my eating window and I don't eat outside of that. I think those kind of extreme approaches towards it tend to cause more problems than they are helpful. And I will speak from experience working with clients who've tried to fast and been like, I'm just so hungry and I just feel like I can't stop eating. And they put these really strict parameters in place that aren't super helpful and are kind of causing more problems than they're worth. So with that said, I have plenty of clients who don't love to eat breakfast and maybe they don't even get hungry till noon and they don't feel like it causes any adverse effects later in the day and they never feel like their cravings are worse or their energy is super low and they just naturally prefer that. They have since they were really young even. I think those are some people that quote unquote fasting would work for, but I don't think of it that way. I just think of it as like, okay, whenever you feel hungry, and as long as we don't have any of these kind of negative ripple effects of pushing that first meal, I think it can be okay. And I will also caveat that one more time with, if somebody's in eating disorder recovery and actively working on their relationship with food, I would not recommend experimenting.
Yeah, that's a good recommendation for sure. I've gone through periods in my life where I've intermittent fasted and it really worked for me for a while. I was in a good headspace in my life. I actually was with my parents for a month and they're retired and they're relaxed. Everything was so chill and it was great. So I could do that. I wasn't obsessing over food at all and I felt very healthy and very good. But I've also had more of a toxic mentality with it too, where I could feel really bloated and I'm like, okay, the next day I just need to not eat until noon or one or something like that. And what do? I'm probably eating by like 10 because my thoughts are just consumed with food in general. So I definitely think that what you're saying is really appropriate. Like if you're doing it and you're not having like obsessive thoughts about food, then that's working for you. But you need to be aware when you're having obsessive thoughts about food and your mind's just racing and thinking about food, that's not what you want to be doing. Like I always find that when I'm thinking about food in the morning, I'm going to eat breakfast. And when I do, when I lean into that, I feel a lot better. So, but then there are other times, and this is my next question, where I eat something like whether it's a lot of cheese or like a big bowl of pasta or carbs or something like, which I will do. I find that maybe sometimes it's hard on my stomach. And as a result, I'm super bloated. And if it's during that time of the month, I'm especially bloated. And that used to be very triggering for me. And that would almost always result in a behavior. I'd wake up bloated and I felt like I would just have to have the eating disorder behavior, the binge and purge, almost like fix it and make myself feel better. I don't do that anymore, but while I was still recovering, it was very difficult for me to be able to sit with the bloated feeling. So do you have advice on alleviating the bloat and sitting with that uncomfortable feeling? And honestly, are there ways to prevent it from happening in the first place, like avoiding certain foods?
Okay. I love that you're bringing this up because you addressed this part that I didn't even talk about, which is fasting can be like compensatory. Instead of going to the gym first thing to quote unquote burn off what you overate last night, you just don't eat or you fast. So it can totally just be this way that our eating disorder or our brain just latches onto a way to compensate for whatever choice we made. Ironically, and most people have no idea that they're doing this in the moment, but having large stretches of time where you're not eating and then having large meals all at once, high volume meals, that is one of the causes of bloating, is just eating past the point of fullness after not having a lot in your stomach all day. And one of the ways we can combat bloating is eating more frequently and actually letting things move through our system versus sit there in our stomachs. And so it's so counterintuitive, but if you wake up bloated in the morning, actually eating and focusing on regular meals could help you more than restricting. Seems so backwards. And it's so hard for people to accept that at first when they hear it.
It is. But then I think about that happening to me. And like, if there are nights where I have a huge dinner and then I wake up and maybe I don't eat until lunch, I am feeling bad again by the time I'm eating lunch rather than like if I would have had breakfast and things would have been moving. So I think that really makes sense.
Yeah. And to your point, yeah, you would eat breakfast, you would feel better. You might not have like the best body image day if you're feeling bloated, but your energy and your digestion is going to move and kind of get back to normal a lot faster. And then yeah, at lunch, you're probably going to eat less or eat more moderately and be able to be mindful. Not that eating less is always the goal, but you can be so much more in touch with your hunger and fullness cues by lunchtime because you had something and didn't try to push it as far as possible.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard. Especially if you come from having an eating disorder and bad body image, if you're feeling bloated, chances are you're not going to feel happy and you're going to really take that to heart. At least that's what I did. And I've said this before, but I find that we use our eating disorder behaviors to numb rather than sit with the uncomfortable feelings. And I think the more you are able to really sit with it and just make healthy choices for yourself, the better off you will be. And I can say that from my own experience. So I guess my final question for this almost rapid fire is, what is your best advice for getting out of the cycle of dieting and disordered eating behaviors?
You know, it depends on the cycle you find yourself in. If you are engaging in kind of compensating for your choices, you may have a different approach than if you're completely restricting versus if you have purging behavior. So everybody is going to have some nuance and personalized advice there. But I think you hit the nail on the head with it's so important, and it's probably the hardest thing to do, to sit with the uncomfortable feeling of whatever triggers your eating disorder thought or your disordered eating thoughts in your head, stress around food and anxiety. Most people, it's this feeling of fullness. It's bloated. I'm having a bad body image day and I want to fix it. And so our brain immediately goes into, okay, here's the plan. We're going to restrict, we're going to compensate, we're going to exercise. Like, we know how to, in theory, get rid of whatever this pain is that we're feeling. And to your point, like, that is kind of where disordered eating starts. Like, we all kind of start there and it can take root and take hold and develop into something a lot more serious. But if you sit with that bad body image feeling, if you sit with just like being bloated, if you eventually are able to take those steps, even if it's not what you want to do, even if it's, you know, everything in your body is telling you to go with kind of the old way that you would do it, over time, to your point, you start to feel better. You start to get more resilient at sitting with those bad, negative feelings, and you realize that you can survive them. And so often it's like we're trying to run from them instead of sit with them and being able to sit with them without coping in those negative ways or coming up with positive coping behaviors is really the way forward. And that's so easy for me to say, and it's so hard to actually do. And that's why working with a therapist and a dietitian is so important.
Even when it feels like you're not making progress, if you are sitting and being able to sit through those uncomfortable feelings and the bloat or just the bad body image or whatever it is, there's stuff going on behind the scenes. Like, in your brain, you're creating new pathways in your brain, new healthy pathways in your brain. So if you decide one day to quit the bad behavior and you do that over and over again, you're going to establish a new pathway in your brain. So your brain will then one day choose the good behavior rather than the bad behavior, because you've taken that pathway so many times, it just becomes used to it. And I think neuroscience is really fascinating. It's almost like you have to trust the science. There's proven science behind this. I trust the science even on the bad days. And I still have uncomfortable bad body image days, but I am a testament. I do not engage in binge eating anymore. And that's like the biggest win in my life. So I just think that it's amazing to be able to talk to you about this and hear from an expert. And I want more people to understand that this doesn't have to be in your life for the long term.
I love what you said. And I think of it as like a piggy bank. Like every day you're putting something in your piggy bank. You're not going to notice from yesterday to today that extra money that's in there. But when you look back over a year, you're going to be like, I've saved so much money. Like I have made so many changes, and they accumulate over time to really help you feel like you have seen that progress. It's back to like that gradually, suddenly feeling is like, it just feels like you're not making any changes. But if you keep going, you will see it when you look back.
I think that's an excellent visualization. I'm all about like being able to picture analogies in my head. So I really love that. This is what I want to wrap up segment one with. For segment two, we'll get into two final questions and close this out. For segment number two, I typically ask the listeners two questions. One is for a recommendation. So we'll start there. So for a recommendation, this could really be anything, but I love to hear about like what you're loving, what you're using maybe online. A lot of the times I will recommend, or someone who I'm interviewing will recommend something that helps them in recovery or helps their clients in recovery, whether it's a meditation channel or an app or a book or something. So what recommendations do you have?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, we just wrapped up talking about body image. So I have to recommend the Body Image Workbook. The Body Image Workbook is so amazing. And I do recommend going through it with like a dietitian or a therapist, because it's a hefty, lengthy exercises that it's going to take you through. And it can be helpful to process that out loud. But I think what we're talking about is just surfing those ups and downs. And if you can understand body image, and if you can understand that it's fleeting, and you could literally wake up today with horrible body image and wake up tomorrow with amazing body image, it has nothing to do with how our bodies actually look or what's happening objectively. Sometimes it feels like it does, but it's totally not logical having a bad body image today. Understanding the science, I think, is a really helpful tool. So yeah. I've got to make that recommendation. And then I have others if you want me to keep going. Okay. Obviously, if people haven't read Intuitive Eating by Evelyn Tribble and her co-author, then I would recommend that book. And I would maybe even consider, if you decide to work with a dietitian, or if you're just going to like kind of dabble in picture-based nutrition tracking, I really love apps that you can take a picture, and then it's also going to prompt you with some mindful eating, intuitive eating questions. So it's going to ask like, how are you feeling energy-wise, mood-wise before this meal? Let's check in. Like, are we already anxious before we even walk into this meal? And then you can also get in touch with hunger and fullness cues through those kinds of apps. So looking at how hungry you feel before your meal, how full you feel after, how satisfied totally the meal is. So I think those can be really wonderful tools. The app that I use in my practice is Practice Better, which is designed for dietitians. So you have to work with a dietitian to use the app, of course. And then for folks in recovery, they may have been familiar with like Recovery Record, super popular one as well.
I love the idea of using a mindful eating app. And I was just recently introduced to the idea of mindful eating, and it's been really helpful. I've even shared it with my friends who don't necessarily have any disordered eating behaviors, but just want to slow down when they're eating. And it's like, when I was in the thick of my eating disorder, I had no idea how I was feeling before, after, during, whatever. It was just a let's get this done. Let's get this over with, using food as a drug, basically. But when you can sit down and be at peace with your meal, it makes you enjoy your meal so much more. Like asking yourself, like you said, how are you feeling? Do you like the taste of this food? Do you like the texture? Do you even like what you're eating right now? Like, you can go change that. Go heat it up or go add like more cracked pepper. I'm always adding pepper to everything. And, you know, it's been really nice to chew my food. And I'm a notoriously extremely fast eater and drinker. And that also kind of gets me bloated a lot from time to time. And it's when I'm enjoying my food and enjoying the moment and have no distractions and learning that concept and being true to mindful eating, it's been really wonderful and worked wonders for me.
I love that. And such a simple mindful eating exercise is just doing like a quick check-in with your five senses. Like, how does this food look? Is it colorful? Is there a color I wish was on my plate? Is it not colorful at all? Like, how does it look? How does it taste? How does it feel? Is it crunchy? Is it salty? Does it need more of one of those textures? It can really make you so much more present, to your point. And yeah, if it's not quite warm enough, you can heat it up and that would change your experience of eating it so much. So just looking at your senses and paying attention while you're eating it can give you a lot of good info.
Yeah, I really like that. Everything you recommended, I'll link in the show notes. So I'll list all of the authors and links to everything. For my next question, this podcast is all about self-love. I hated myself for a long time. I engaged in terrible behaviors that just brought me down and numbed me and made me sad for way too many years of my life. I'm all about self-love. I journal every single day. I sign off my journal entries with, "I love you." I think it's important to rewire our brains in a way where we can actively accept love from ourselves and be our own friends. So I would love to hear, what's something that you love about yourself?
Oh, I love that. It is such a practice to love yourself, right? Yeah. Like, you have to remind yourself. And I think for so many people, it feels like abnormal or like so foreign to say anything that resembles love for yourself. But okay. Well, recently I just started using like fancy shampoo. It's so random. But so I've like really started taking my hair more seriously. And I feel like that's something that you don't have to do until you get like older. I mean, I'm not that old by any means, but so I'm like starting to love my hair and taking that seriously and skincare and taking that seriously. So I'm like really loving all things hair and skin right now for me.
Are you doing any hair oiling or anything like that?
I haven't done any oil. I've done like a hair mask in the past, and that's probably like as adventurous as I've gone.
I'm just trying to dabble in the oil right now, but I also like work from home. I take any excuse not to wash my hair for as long as possible. But something else that we have in common is that we're both getting married next year. So I'm like, if now's the time for us to fully embrace getting our hair right and getting our skin right, it's right now. So also congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, that's so true. And yeah, it is so wild to be getting married. And like, you do feel the pressure of wanting to look, quote unquote, your best on your wedding day. And there's so many things in the wedding industry that can be triggering. But yeah, it's nice to feel really confident and want to show up just as exactly what you look like and not have to alter it.
Extremely. Right. And love yourself the way that you are. And I know that's so much easier said than done. And that's something that I'm truly working on, that I feel like we could do another whole episode about how to be okay with your body on your wedding day, no matter what you look like. But more to come from that. Where can the listeners find you?
Yeah. So my website, carolinethomason.com, super straightforward. You can get in touch with me there if you do have an interest in being a client, or you can just follow along on Instagram, Dietitian Caroline with an underscore at the end.
She's a great follow, Caroline Thomason. I really appreciate you coming on. I think this is a start to a great relationship for us. So I think this was great.
Amazing. Well, yeah, let's definitely do part two all about wedding preparation.
Yes, we actually really should. So, okay, that was great. I really, really thought that was awesome.
That was was Caroline Thomason, not your average dietitian. I thought she was amazing, and I will definitely be having her on again to pick her brain on all things wedding. Obviously, this is the only thing I'm talking about right now, guys. But honestly, I do think that one thing that is a work in progress for me is not putting pressure on myself to look a certain way. It's definitely gotten a lot better over the years. I'm thinking back to like spring break wearing a bathing suit in high school. That really used to get to me, but we're taking it one day at a time, healing one day at a time, and getting better every single day. Thank you all so much for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks with entry 16. We've got another interview with a great guest, so be sure to tune in then. This podcast was written and produced by me, Amy Geckel, with music from Coma Media. Stay tuned on Instagram for updates at The Eating Disorder Diaries, and if you want someone to talk to, DM me there or email me. Amy is linked in the show notes along with everything else we discussed in today's episode. Thank you again for listening, and I'll talk to y'all soon.